Group meeting, Saturday, 20th September, 1986. Last July, we just began Chapter 5, which is titled Communion. And I'll read the last paragraph again, which I read. Through him who is whole and pure, the world awakens out of unknowing communion into perfect communion. The world does not know it, but he is a light. In the darkness, he is the light of the world, and his awakened state is the timeless communion of the nameless unknown with all the world, through him, the star of truth, the heart of love. The chapter starts with mentioning the unknowing communion in which the whole universe exists, but the universe doesn't know it. But it is in communion. If it is, even if it is only the communion of contingency, that is touch, a boulder which is resting on the earth, that boulder is in communion with the earth. Consciousness is an extraordinary thing. The supreme transcendent consciousness is all-knowing in the true sense of the term. Our brains cannot grasp precisely what that all-knowingness is like. It's very difficult. But if you are ever able to enter in the deepest states of meditation, then you will find, you will get a touch of that all-knowingness. And once you get that touch, forever it remains with you. Not that you, as such, become all-knowing. That is to say, you, the psychophysical organism, the existential being. But the existential being is the apparatus for transcendence itself. And that's how the realization affects, through you, the whole of mankind. You know how, for instance, how Jesus said, I and my Father are one. Now, Jesus realized that transcendent holistic state. And because he realized it, it affects the whole world, the whole human race. When anybody realizes one of the supreme purposes for which the human race exists, namely the realization of this state of complete communion, if anyone realizes that, then it affects all mankind. But we can't see the effects. But you know it inwardly. Not as an idea, not as a belief, as a conviction, but with that transcendent knowing, which I have generally called the unknowing knowing. You see? So, that's why I wrote here, through him who is whole and pure, the world awakens out of unknowing communion into perfect communion. So the person who has realized that state, the saintly person who is completely clear seeing. He is the star of truth. One might say, well, if he is the star of truth, why doesn't everybody see him? Consider in relation to this, at night when we have a really brilliantly starry night, how many people look at the stars? And how do they look? Perfunctorily. They are unable really to see the star as a star, a self-shining light, a herald, if you like, of eternity and infinity. That's what a star is. And a human being who becomes the star of truth is like that. But the human beings around him, of all the human beings around him, very few are sensitive enough, developed enough, to be able to look and recognize, yes, here is the star of truth. And of course, also therefore, the heart of love. To be thus is man's religious fulfillment. Being in communion, this is the heart of religion. Now, in the distant dawn of his emergence, man, like the very creature out of which he evolved, was in unknowing communion. Man started like that. Adam and God were on speaking terms with each other, a teaching which calls for deep contemplation. You read Genesis carefully, and you find that the Lord God speaks with Adam. They were on speaking terms with each other. Adam was not the first man in the literal scientific sense of the first specimen of the human race. And besides, the date given to him, roughly about 4004 BC, may be true enough for a person who realized holistic consciousness. That is the significance of saying that God spoke to him. That is why one must be capable of deep contemplation in order to understand the writings in scripture. Man, as a child, he was a child then, was receptive and responsive directly. And in simple terms, for mind was fresh and innocent. If the mind is not innocent, and remember the first meaning, the primary meaning of the word innocent is innocuous, harmless. And if one is really harmless, then there is the possibility of true communion with the totality, with God, if you like. His mind did not work upon itself, and so he lived in delight. Adam is supposed to have lived in the Garden of Eden, at least for a time, as the Bible story puts it. And the word Eden, the meaning of that word is delight. Delight, which the ordinary person will interpret as sensational delight, excitement, ecstasy, standing beside yourself, being beside yourself. It's nothing of that sort. It's being completely aware of the within yourself. And the within yourself is transcendence. The whole of transcendence itself is there. And so that is a delight which is ineffable. It is associated with complete peace, with total harmony. That delight is not the delight which man pursues on the globe to this day. He chases sensational excitement. And that is his one of the most destructive factors in his life. Because in chasing sensational excitement, he associates that with so much worldliness, with becoming very rich, for example, with having this, that and the other pleasure. All these things are temporal. They are mortal. They are not the immortal. It is one of the purposes of our existence as human beings to discover the immortal. And we discover it not by finding it like you'd find some object in the house which you had forgotten where you put it, and you go searching for it and find it. It's not like that. It is the immortal which finds you. You know, there are so many people, literally hundreds of people, who will say with great passion, "I must find God." Well, I tell them, go and find space. And they say, but I don't have to find space, it is here. I said, space is like God. Here. It's curious that the theistic religions have all presented God as not only omnipotent and omniscient, but omnipresent. But how many of the 5 billions of people on the globe today are aware, are awake to the omnipresence of God? How do they behave? How do they live? Not specially godlike, are they? There we are. So now, man ate the fruit of the tree of good and evil. And he disobeyed, as we say, the command or the request which God made. He said, "For when you eat of the fruit of the tree of good and evil, you will surely die." That is how Eve put it to the serpent when he came along to tempt them. What is the meaning of the fruit of the tree of good and evil? And don't forget that in the Garden of Eden, that tree is in the middle of the garden. And at the same time, it is said that the tree of life is also in the middle of the garden. If you eat of the fruit of the tree of life, you realize immortality. And only the utterly pure one can dare put forth his hand and eat of the fruit of the tree of life. Because that fruit transmutes our worldly consciousness into the transcendent holistic consciousness. But the tree of good and evil, the fruit of that tree, is the dualistic consciousness. Good, evil. Pleasant, painful. Ugly, beautiful. And so forth. You see? So, this dualistic consciousness plays its part. And because the dualistic consciousness plays its part, man is in confusion, he is in a state of contradiction, and in a state of permanent conflict. Because that other element is embodied in him, the transcendent element is embodied in him. And whilst that transcendent element never compels man in any respect, it affects his consciousness, which has sunk to this level of dualistic, contradictory, confused state. You remember, in the cool of the evening, God was walking about in the garden, as it is put in Genesis, and he says, "Adam, where art thou?" Now, God has no need to ask that question. He is all-seeing. Adam and God couldn't play hide-and-seek like you and I have played hide-and-seek when we were children. You see? Where art thou, Adam? At what level, in what condition is your consciousness? There is the meaning of that question. And God is the transcendent element within man himself, which asks the existential being, "Where are you? What are you doing?" So, with growing separative self-consciousness, man's mind turned inward and talked speculatively. It produced conceptions and, alas, fixed them. All our fixed conceptions are a burden. They are a drawback to human fulfillment, which means also human well-being, perfect well-being, and the consciousness of the immortal. So that dualistic mind exercised discriminative choice in favor of pleasure against pain. Thus, the natural unknowing wholeness of man's being was split asunder, seeking one at the cost of the other, and producing a state of conflict. You see, one of the deepest teachings that the great spiritual teachers gave the world, but didn't put it in this particular form in which I'm suggesting it. Krishnamurti came pretty close to it, but he didn't use just this exact language. We have to learn to live in the world in its totality. The tiger kills the antelope because it is hungry. That is not evil. That is how it is. That is the law of its being. We, being human, need to avoid killing anything in order to satisfy hunger and live upon it. you see. Similarly, with people who do wrong, and terrible wrong, evil, look at the extraordinary amount of callous murder that has been going on, particularly since 1969. IRA and Lebanon and all these things. You see, they are terrible, they are awful. But it is here with us. I will go a step further. It is here in me, myself. Don't I have feelings and thoughts, I wish so and so were dead? How often have we experienced that? So you see, if we are incapable of taking what is actually present and seeing it for what it is, we cannot heal that which is sick. We can't do it. Look at peace treaties. Why do all peace treaties ultimately fail? And another war springs up. Because having already had a war, then the victor lays down terms to the conquered. And the conquered stores up in his mind the day which is to come when he will get his own back, as he says, as he will say, from the conqueror, and destroy him, destroy the conqueror. And this horrible story of man's life has gone on for countless millennia, not just centuries, but millennia. It is very hard to say this. When you hear the news and hear of these absolutely callous, senseless murders which take place practically every day. In fact, they do take place every day. Watch your feelings, watch your thoughts, and see of what nature they are. Unless there is complete acceptance and the willingness to love, to help the evildoer, you can't do anything about the situation. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus speaks of this. He says the Mosaic law, of course he's referring to the Mosaic law, he just says the law says, hate your enemies, but I say unto you, love your enemies. How do you love your enemies? Not by sentimentality, not by accepting the idea that we ought to love our enemies. They are, such ideas are impotent. We see that in the history of the world. But by being able to see the fact as the fact, this man is a callous murderer. You see, all right, he is a callous murderer. And murdering brings about such and such sorrow, pain, horror in the lives of so many people. Not just the murdered or just one or two, but many others. See that fact, and if one remains at peace within oneself, then from within oneself there can go out an energy, invisible, but quite a powerful energy which can affect healing. You know, for instance, that the sun is the source of life and light and warmth to all of us. And without the sun, we would just perish, completely perish. The surface of the sun is about 6,000 degrees. The center of the sun is about 40 million degrees. Now, in that center, there takes place a continuous hydrogen atomic explosion. Four hydrogen nuclei combine through that explosion to form one helium atom. And at the same time, a gamma ray photon is liberated from the center. And that photon undergoes many changes as it penetrates through the mass of the sun. Now do remember, the sun is not solid. It's gaseous. It's all hot air. You see? And when it comes out from the surface of the sun, it comes as a ray of light to us. Similarly with the heat. So the heat and the light sustains our life. Now we couldn't possibly go even to the surface of the sun. We'd be frizzled, and frizzled to such an extent that we would be quite inedible to any sort of creature or monster. You see? But that's what happens in order that life, well-being, growth may take place in the world. Now the sun doesn't say, I will send light and heat to this farmer, he's a good chap. You see? But I will frizzle up that awful heretic Firoz Mehta for upsetting the usual conceptions which the religions have put forward. You see? The sun doesn't say that. It just is itself. At 40 million degrees centigrade at its center, it keeps on doing all that and will keep on for several thousand million years at least. We have to be like the sun. If we are like that, you see, in human terms, which means love, intelligence, selflessness, then we spread an influence by our very existence. You get the point? You see how it is? That is what exercises a real healing influence. Well now, the unknowing wholeness of man's being was split asunder by discriminative choice in favor of pleasure against pain. He was now in the state of sin, and he lost pure delight. In his mind there appeared the darkness of confusion, the conflict of good with evil, of the is of what actually is with what ought to be according to man's conceptions. Remember, we human beings throughout the world say, oh, it ought to be done like this, we don't like this, it ought to be that. Who am I, possessed of an ordinary, imperfect brain and mind, you see, to decide what ought to be? You see, it's an extraordinary conceit which afflicts mankind. It ought to be like this. No, see what actually is. And in that seeing, you will discover that compassion rises up in you and flows out towards the what is. If the what is bad, it will be healed, it will be made better. If it is good, it will be made still more good. And it all just happens naturally. Like everything on the planet Earth happens naturally because the sun is what it is. Yes, and then I go on, and so it is today. Only when the mind clearly knows itself for what it is, does it cease to sunder the unity of being and to obtrude upon the silence of eternity. We are the noisemakers of the world. We human beings. And we human beings are the great interferers with the natural life process of the world. Then, when we cease, when the mind clearly knows itself, then sin ends with redemption and conflict cools down into peace. Wrapped in unknowing communion in his infancy, man enjoyed his golden age. People call that a golden age, but that is just a wishful vision. In our present dark age, recorded as history, there have appeared redeemers and enlightened ones. Theirs was not an unknowing communion, nor was their awareness of truth a knowing by a self-conscious mind. Whilst they lived, theirs was the perfect communion. So, in the timeless now, they are the restorers of communion for us. See, that's one of the great influences that emanates from him who has really seen. Mysteriously, man always hears the call or sees a picture of the long-lost Eden. He does not understand this pull at his heart, for its meaning is twisted by the usual condition of the mind. The conditioned brain does all that. Yet, through scores of thousands of years, some men experienced revelations which gave them an ineradicable conviction of the reality of the transcendent and inspired them with a hope and a faith in a way of life which led to a heavenly goal where this high God was no idle dream, was not only a pious aspiration but an eternal home and an ever-present felicity. These realizations of communion, dimly understood but intensely experienced, were treasured as the spiritual heritage of the race. The long waves of life followed each other. In our present tide, the established great religions all affirm the transcendent, the ways thereto, and the life abundant, which is the fruit of treading the way. In wonderfully rich and beautiful forms have these affirmations been made. For through the many millennia, man's power of speech has flowered. This is the difference between the half-dumb Arshurian of a bygone eon and us today. This speech is the language of poetry, for poetry can tell of the silence of the unity. But when speech is the noise of argumentative intellectual discourse, it is the language of duality, of confusing division. The great secret, the hidden mystery, the inmost esoteric truth of the spiritual realization, which is the ineffable communion, is the silence.